you would turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. Yeah, the book of Ecclesiastes. Lately, we've been spending most of our time in the New Testament. There's a verse that Bill brought up. I figured, actually, let's go back and spend some time in Ecclesiastes, because Ecclesiastes is a really good contrast book if you want to compare that to what's going on in the New Testament. Possibly one of the best books if you want to contrast what God revealed before versus what God revealed after. And yeah, as I get older, I actually like Ecclesiastes more than I used to. But even still, there's various things about it that, you know, that I'm still a little uncomfortable with. Knowing progressive revelation actually tells you a lot more than Solomon knew, helps a good deal. But still, there's a lot of it. It's, I don't know, when I read it, this is often just a very depressing but realistic kind of book. I want to read large chunks. Where we're going is the end, and this is the verse that Bill brought up, and it's good to bring these up because they get to test our interpretive muscles, all right, and help us think about the text. And so on Ecclesiastes 12, he was asking the question, all right, so how does this particular verse, Ecclesiastes 12, 7, how does it fit in? And so Ecclesiastes 12, 7, and this is continuing on a long sentence, but it says, "And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." You know, we've been discussing a lot what happens to the spirit. What happens to man after he is dead? All right, and so this seems like it might actually have some relevance. I actually don't think so, but all right, we'll turn to it, and I'll show you why. But before we do that, let's spend some time getting a good dose of Solomon's realistic / pessimistic view of things. Turn to earlier in the book. So we start, for example, in chapter 2, verse 12. Right? "So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after wind." In Ecclesiastes, Solomon repeatedly is struggling with the problem of vanity, of you do good things, and then what does it come to? Nothing, really, in terms of long-term human achievement, right? You work all your life, all right? You work all your life. You accomplish great things. Yeah, nobody's probably going to remember you anyway. This is the kind of struggle here. And what he's got here, he's like, okay, what about is it better to be wise than a fool? Yes, it's better to be wise than a fool, right? But they are actually going to go to the same place. So that's all kind of vain. Now, as you think about that, just contrast that a little bit with New Testament concept. If someone were to come to you and say, you know what, there's just no advantage of being good over evil. Let's just be unwise. Let's just do whatever we want. There's really no advantage. You're going to die. I'm going to die. None of us can take any of this stuff with us. What's the purpose of even trying? Well, one of our notions that we should bring up at that point is, well, we Christians believe two things. One, after death there is judgment, and so therefore what you do in life absolutely affects you after your life. And two, as a part of that, on the positive side, there is hope for the Christian. There is not only a lack of judgment, but a hope for resurrection from the dead. All right? That's a very positive view of things, and also something that solves some of the moral dilemmas. All right? Because it is a moral dilemma for man. All right? If you don't have any sort of concept of God, right? Where is justice in this world? You don't have a very good answer. For us, we understand that there will be justice served, hopefully in this life, but even if not in this life, we know justice will ultimately be served because God is a God of justice, and he must, because of his own nature, do that. So we have this idea, but if you don't believe in a God, then, well, there's all sorts of vanity, all right? There's all sorts of what's the purpose in all of this. There's really no basis for any idea of injustice in this life will be meted out later on, right? You just have no category for that. Now, Solomon obviously is not an atheist, all right? He talks about God quite a bit in this, but yet there's this hopelessness that shows up so much in this book, all right? That ultimately often he comes down to is there's a whole lot of vanity yet. Yeah, there is. So let's enjoy the life that God has given us. Let's do our work. Let's enjoy our work. Let's enjoy the fruit of our work as long as we are alive. Because being alive is better than being dead. Okay? That's a very different kind of notion than what we think of later because of progressive revelation. So let's look now back again in Ecclesiastes. Chapter 2, we'll just continue on. I hated all my toil. This is verse 18 in chapter 2. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Now, if we think about what happened with Solomon specifically, how'd the kingdom go after he left? Not well, all right? Not well at all. As a matter of fact, it broke up. And things went very poorly. So as it turns out, all his hard work was inherited by a fool. Yet he will be master of all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. You know, life is short and then you die. All right, that kind of notion here. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. And this is something that comes from God. He recognizes it here. Like I said, he's certainly no atheist. These things come from God, and God has given us this life. God has given us this work. We should enjoy our toil, and we should enjoy the things that come after that and the fruits of that. Yet, there's still a note of vanity. Chapter 3, for everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, and here we have the most famous part of the book, a time to be born and a time to die. And notice how it has this same kind of contrast of, it's okay, it's not okay, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh. Time to mourn, a time to dance, time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it, so that people fear before him. That which is, already has been. That which is to be, already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. A lot of the same notions as before. All right. Once again, what is God's gift to man? This is Solomon's earthliness, all right, and not in a bad way, all right? We could, in theory, embrace an error that would basically say, all right, nothing matters here. All that matters is eternity. I'm going to deny all human pleasures for eternity, all right? That's very much not Solomon's approach to things. And Solomon's approach to things is recognizing that God created man to be human, to live on this earth, to enjoy it. That's a notion, all right? Now, he's also, of course, recommends that we be wise in everything. And even as Christians, we know that, okay, eternity is obviously longer than this time. And there are certainly times to give up our earthly pleasures. And there are certain pleasures that we must absolutely avoid. But perhaps Solomon, in his realism and in his pessimism, can help us stay more grounded and realize that, you know what, actually, God intended us to work. That's what God made Adam for. And God made Adam to work so that he can enjoy the earth. And that's the same for us. And so we should work and we should enjoy it. And we should take pleasure in our toil. But also, because we know a great deal more, I think, than Solomon, we should also think about eternity and make sure we live this life, which is in toil, all right? And then sometimes a serious lack of pleasure, sometimes pleasure, make sure all of it fits in with an eternal plan. So Solomon, I think, is extremely useful in this. And but still, he doesn't know, really, half of that equation, I don't think. But we'll get into more of that, especially in this next paragraph. It's very interesting. Now we're in chapter 3, verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of men, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. And before we go on, God is going to judge the righteous and the wicked. Where is this going to happen? All right. Sometimes on earth, but we also know there's a future judgment. This paragraph is very fascinating for me. Verse 19, for what happens to the children of men or man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and dust all return. Now, this next verse, we'll have to see what everybody's translations have. ESV has, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? So I saw there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? All right, other translations, specifically of verse 21. King James, anybody?
Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth?
And that translation ends with a period, correct?
A question mark.
It does? Okay.
The NIV.
So is the NIV. Ends with a period or a question mark?
Question mark.
Okay. there's a question here, a legitimate question here. Is the author going, I don't know? Or is he actually saying, this is how things work? What's the question? Where does the spirit of man go? All right? Where does it go after it dies? In the ESV, it's very much a, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? All right? Who knows? Who knows? Solomon, right? It's a question in reading. It's a question in the Hebrew. They're like, we don't really know for sure. It certainly fits with Solomon's general approach to things and really, lack of revelation to just go, I don't know. Who knows? All right? With his general realistic / pessimistic outlook. Who knows? All right? When it's all said and done, if man's spirit goes up and we are generally different from beast. Because most of the paragraph is actually, at least right before it, he's like, you know what? We have the same fate as the beasts. They die, we're going to die. They're going to stop breathing, we're going to stop breathing. Which is, of course, a very different kind of perspective than what you get in later in Revelation. Not the book, but later in, the Bible. Let's skip some things. Let's go to chapter 11 of Ecclesiastes. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones of the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. So there's an interpretive question here, and it's the same one that's here later in chapter 12, verse 7, and even applies even to that passage we were just reading, is this. In some languages, and this is not true in English, in some languages they use the same word for breath and spirit. All right? This is true in Hebrew. This is actually true in Greek as well. It's kind of natural, if you think about it. Yeah?
What about Latin? Spiraria?
Breath? That is where we get our English word for inspiration is from Latin. They actually... I'll have to check on that. Okay. I don't actually know. For biblical interpretation, though, fortunately, Latin is actually not something we particularly need to worry about. And so, if you think about it from an ancient person's point of view, what are the differences between someone who is alive and someone who is dead? Well, their heart's not beating, right? You can tell that, but you'd have to feel that, right? You can't just see that. One of the big differences between a living person and a dead person is if they are breathing, right? And what does it seem like whenever someone dies? All right, whatever this force is that's keeping you breathing, right? The breath leaves, all right? That's the idea there. And at what point... And this is a legitimate question throughout both the New and the Old Testament. When you see a word for spirit, all right, when should you think spirit, as in what we think of when we use the English word spirit, all right? It could also mean just wind, which is obviously very similar to, right, blowing wind, breathing wind, which is like a wind that comes out of you. It's also that. But how often is it just breath? And so if you look at this particular word, in this particular verse, what's it saying? Is Solomon asking, at what point does the soul, what point does that inner part of man enters the child who's forming in the womb? Is that what he's asking here? Or is it really a much more simple question? At what point do they start breathing. All right? At what point does breathing happen when the baby is being formed in the womb? Let's read it again. As you do not know the way the breath comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. All right? Just like you don't understand God, you don't even understand when a baby starts to breathe or how that gets there. All right? Is it so? I don't read this and I don't think about at what point does God give a spiritual internal being to a human. I don't think that's the point. I think the point is you don't even know the way all this works as the baby's growing. You don't even know how it starts breathing. If you can't even understand that, how can you understand God? All right. Continuing on. In the morning, sow your seed, and in evening, withhold not your hand. For you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. Here's a really interesting one as well. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. What's he talking about when he's talking about the days of darkness? Is he talking about enjoy your life, but you're going to have lots of dark days in that life? Or is it enjoy your life because after your life is over, it's darkness. And after that, well, that's much longer than your brief, fleeting life. Enjoy it. I tend to take it as the second one. It's enjoy your life while you can see the light of the sun because, you know, when you're 70 or 80 or 90, goodbye. You won't see the sun again. It's going to be dark. You could take it either way. It's a legitimate question. Once again, fitting into Solomon's kind of realistic / pessimistic worldview. What's that? Stoic. It is. It is kind of stoic. He's pre-stoic. He was stoic before the Stoics were stoic. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. When is the question? When? He didn't actually say. I think Ecclesiastes is very much like Proverbs. Sin leads to death. And when they mean that, they mean physical death. All right? I think that what it's talking about here, especially notice the young man part, right? Young man, live wisely because God will bring you into judgment. But it's hard to say. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Why are they vanity? Well, because things are going to break as you get older. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the days draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Now, if you were to go back and take that verse in verse 8 and talk about the days of darkness will be many, then that is very consistent with this particular notion. And say it's, well, maybe this is not talking about time in Sheol, but actually in life. It's hard to say. But here, it's definitely the other notion. All right? We'll start again in chapter 12. Verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few. Pause for a second. What's he talking about here? Grinders are few? Teeth, right? You're losing your teeth. Body's bent. I mean, just talk about old age, right? And the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. I take that as you can't sleep well. I couldn't be wrong. That's how I take it. They are afraid also of what is high, and the tares are in the way. The almond tree blossoms. The grasshopper drags itself along, and the desire fails because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the street. Mourners for death, right? Before the silver cord is snapped and the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the breath returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. All right? So the question is verse 7, is that a upward tilt of, oh, let's switch positive right here at the end before we die? And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Or is it actually just continuing the same thought, which is what I think what's going on here? And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the breath returns to the God who gave it. All right? Think back to the Genesis account, right? Adam was made from dirt. Adam was made from dust, right? And then God breathed into him breath. All right? Now it's the reverse of that. It's breath leaves, and now you're going back to dust. I don't see any positive in this at all. All right? This is just, now you're dead. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. Now, I only have one commentary on Ecclesiastes, so I mostly could only look in that one commentary and look in study Bibles and whatnot. The one commentary I have takes this as a positive note and says this seems like a positive idea, even though he recognizes you don't really see anything of what we see in the New Testament in terms of existence after death to really look forward to. It's a positive note that we at least see explained more in the New Testament. And I just don't see it. And I think, and this is how the Net Bible translated, simply is breath here. I think that makes more sense. It links it back to the Genesis account, just like, enjoy youth. Life's hard, but enjoy youth. And then it's just a succession of things that are going wrong, at which point, eventually, you turn to dust, and your breath is gone. Vanity of vanities, all right? I think that's basically how the paragraph ends, right? Let's finish the book. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying, arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. So at this point, this isn't even Solomon, right? This isn't even Solomon. This is somebody else later on actually reflecting on the book and reflecting on what the preacher has done, right? The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Okay, at what point? Right? That's the question that you often have to ask when you see some of this stuff and go, okay, now please explain to us how this works. All right? God will bring everything to judgment. When? All right? It's like it leaves things in a state of tension. God will judge, all right? If you ask when, well, there's lots of vanity in life, so it's hard to say, right? But we ultimately, as we know, from a later on in Revelation, this does get resolved. But it is certainly, I think, a tension here. And I don't think Solomon's really trying to resolve that tension at all. There's a whole lot of vanity. We have 10 more minutes. Let's turn to Psalms. 49. All right, this is a psalm of the sons of Korah. All right. The reason why I'm picking this one is we have to ask some of the same questions, and it's very parallel to some of the stuff we were reading in Ecclesiastes 3. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world. both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. Why should I fear in times of trouble, when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches. Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, and the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. So you start seeing where this is taking sort of an ecclesiastical term. Not in the sense of church-like, but in the sense of like Ecclesiastes. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations. Though they called their lands by their own names, man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. Right? Very much like Ecclesiastes 3. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Yet after them people approve of their boasts. Like sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Stop. All right, let's think about this part, all right? This is another place where there's like, God will ransom my soul from Sheol, all right? What's he talking about? Is this talking about something after death, or is this talking about something in life, right? Sometimes David would talk this way. And sometimes for him, it was because he was running for his life, right? He was trying to survive when someone was trying to kill him. And he would pray, and he would have confidence in God and say, God will rescue me from Sheol. And what he meant from that is simply that these people want to kill me, but God made a promise to me, and so therefore I have faith and confidence that they actually won't kill me. All right? That's not going to happen because God made a covenant with me, right? That's a notion that you certainly see in David. And so in David, you have to always ask, what's he talking about? What part of his life is he currently living under? Is this during the problematic Absalom time? Is this during the problematic time before he was actually functioning as king when Saul was trying to kill him? All right? You have to ask that question with David. For the sons of Korah, it's not clear to me, at least. What's going on here? God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, meaning my soul will go to Sheol, but at some point God will ransom my soul out of Sheol into another place. Or are they talking about here, actually the upright will live, will not get killed in this particular case. The upright actually shall rule over them in the morning and will avoid Sheol, where the wicked will actually be slain and go to Sheol. It could go either way. I'll let you decide. Verse 16, be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though, while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. And there's that same question that we had to struggle with Ecclesiastes. Is this dark days or is it dark eternity in Sheol? Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. All right. Thoughts?
Do you think Solomon could have
raised
David's soul
and
been inspired by that?
I wouldn't be surprised. But I don't know. David clearly has his low moments, the tenor of so much of David is so much more positive than Solomon, right? Because often David is in a very low place and then goes, boom, but God's promise to me, it's all going to be okay, all right? Ecclesiastes is more like, to me, it's low points, occasional bumps up to high points, but then let's go be realistic and go back to negative. And so it seems to me Solomon doesn't have the positive bent in Ecclesiastes that clearly David had through much of his singing. And, you know, a lot of David's songs are just plain old praise, positive, no negative aspect at all. It's just all, it's all good, right? So,
didn't Solomon fall away some? So do you think that could have played into his negativity in Ecclesiastes?
Yeah, but,
Queen of Sheba.
Yeah.
Kind of give himself that.
Giving himself over to idolatry and marrying too many wives and all that, and really the breakup of the kingdom was partially Solomon's problem, right? He did not prepare well and was in wickedness at the end of his life. When did he write Ecclesiastes? Was it during that very long dark kind of idolatrous time? Was it before that? I don't know. All right, and it's a legitimate question to ask when you think about biblical revelation, all right, in the Bible, okay? Is God going to put a book into the scriptures that's essentially written by someone who's in a state of general unbelief? Well, Solomon in Ecclesiastes is in a state of belief, all right? It just doesn't show up nearly as much as a lot of the other parts of that idea in Ecclesiastes show up. So Ecclesiastes is not a book full of idolatry and about worshiping other gods. And so it's not teaching that. And so that makes me think, okay, this is not something that Solomon would have put together in the midst of his problematic idolatry. But still, in terms of the spirit of the thing, not in the sense of the spirit, but in the sense of the feel of the thing, it's very un-Davidic. It's very much unlike his father, and is very. There's lots of bad here. Enjoy your life while you can, because it's going to be dark, and teeth are going to fall out. And eventually, you're going to rot and stop breathing. So, enjoy it while you can. Which, I think there's some wisdom in that. Yes, Chip.
One of the that comes to mind is the very beginning of Solomon's reign. Instead of praying for wealth, he prays for wisdom to rule these people.
Mm-hmm.
This could be the result of his failure to retain that wisdom. And he falls into this nihilistic moment here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we can't really call it nihilistic, right? Because nihilism depends on the idea that there is no God. But yeah, certainly a very negative thing.
Pessimistic.
Yeah. 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 There's a realism or pessimism here that is very interesting in this book that I don't see anywhere else. Okay, we do have a hard stop. Yeah?
Well, you know, whenever after David's adultery,
yeah,
then he fasts, hoping that God might not kill the child, but mm-hmm. the child dies, and if you remember, the servants come, and he realizes that the child has died, and so he gets up and
washes his face,
and says, bring me some food. And they're like, what's going on? And he makes this statement, who can tell whether God will be gracious unto me and whether the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back? I'll go to him, but he shall not return to me. And I've heard people try to make a lot out of that.
Mm-hmm.
David's like, well, you know, he's in heaven and I'm going to heaven. I could read that and just say, God judge me. He's dead.
I'm going to be dead too. Yeah. Agree. Yeah, I think you're right on that. Elliot, will you pray for us, please?